Support for The World's Podcast comes from LegalZoom. With over 17 years and more than 2 million customers, LegalZoom provides helpful support, legal advice, and transparency for business owners. More information at LegalZoom.com/world.
Ilhan Omar and Israel, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Minnesota's Ilhan Omar won over many people on her way to getting elected to Congress, including this rabbi based in Jerusalem, who's now upset by Omar's comments about Israel.
I so believe in what she's doing for the most part, but I also feel that she, like other people, are identifying us as a problem that's not in proportion at all.
And later, some in the UK are worried that Brexit will allow U.S. chicken into British supermarkets, and the Brits aren't keen on how Americans process our poultry. The U.S. ambassador's response?
American farmers care about their land just as much as they do here, and their animals.
The great British debate over American chlorinated chicken. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar is at the center of a massive debate in Congress right now over what she said and tweeted about Israel. Was it anti-Semitic, or was it a call for discussion about U.S. policy toward Israel and Israeli policy toward the Palestinians?
Nobody ever gets to have the broader debate of what is happening with Palestine.
Just part of what the first-term Democrats said last week. We'll hear more of Omar's comment in a moment. Here's something to keep in mind, though. What Omar said is like a Rorschach test for many people who are in the middle of this debate. Everyone is going to see something different. Susan Silverman is an American rabbi who lives in Jerusalem. And again, she's just one voice and one set of ears. We caught up with her today while she was traveling. This is Silverman's reaction to Omar's comments.
The enthusiasm, the excitement when she was elected, when AOC was elected, like, it was just like my reaction was so joyful. And then to feel like, oh, but I don't count in this. They don't like us. They're, you know, identifying us as uniquely evil in the world, you know. And it was just I can only describe it as just so painful and sad.
Well, a lot of people are talking about the comments she made, and I think it's important that we actually hear them and put it in context. So this clip where she spoke last Wednesday at a panel in Washington at a coffee shop called Poets and Busboys, it's a bit long, but I think it's important to hear the whole thing.
It almost as if every single time we say something, regardless of what it is we say, that is supposed to be about foreign policy or engagement, our advocacy about ending oppression or the freeing of every human life and wanting dignity, we get to be labeled in something and that ends the discussion because we end up defending that and nobody ever gets to have the broader debate of what is happening with Palestine. The political influence in this country that says it is okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country.
So she says there at the end, I want to talk about the political influence in this country, i.e. the U.S., that says it's okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country, presumably referring to Israel there. Susan Silverman, what did you hear in there that troubles you?
The whole dual loyalty thing is an ancient trope. And I agree with her. I agree that I don't want to get stuck on semantics. I want to be able to get into the issues on all levels regarding Israel and regarding the world. But the reality is, you know, people describe it as brave to come out against Israel. It's actually the opposite of brave on the left. What would be brave on the left is to say there's actually a really complex situation there, that the Jewish state is not uniquely evil in the situation. And that, you know, we're in the context of a much larger world. So if you really care about moving us forward in terms of social justice issues, wow, work with us. Don't villainize us.
So you said Correct. You agree with Ilhan Omar. I mean, what's the problem?
I agree that we don't want to get stuck on who's a racist, who's an anti-Semite, who's a this, who's a that, instead of like getting to the heart of issues. But I feel that
isn't that what she's trying to do, though?
She is.
I mean, it's others calling her the anti-Semite.
Both things can be true. You can oppose the occupation and you cannot uniquely identify Israel and the world as uniquely evil. Because we're not.
Maybe Representative Omar was not even thinking dual loyalty. She just wanted to open up a debate and say, can we talk openly about this? I mean, is that a possibility?
That's definitely a possibility. And listen, I want nothing more than to work with her. Like, her election, like, in a normal universe would give me so much joy. And instead, every time I see her, my heart just sinks because I so want to be allies together. I so believe in what she's doing for the most part. But I also feel that she, like other people, are identifying us as a problem that's not in proportion at all. Help move us forward. Be our partners on the left there. You know, it's really, we're scared in Israel. A lot of people are scared in Israel. And you know what? For good reason. Hear us, have empathy, just like it's taken white people a really long time to understand, like, our complicity in racism in the U.S. I think people need to take seriously their complicity in anti-Semitism in the world and how that masquerades as anti-Zionism, but it's not different. It's just not.
There are white male Republicans on Capitol Hill who have made anti-Semitic comments and played with tropes. Would these comments have been heard differently if they'd been made by someone who is not Muslim or a Muslim woman not wearing hijab?
For me, they'd be heard differently because I want nothing to do with those people in any case other than try to move the country forward. Their hatred of me is almost affirming, right? Because I have nothing politically in common with them. So for me, it's just so painful coming from the left because those are my people. And they're abandoning me and they're not giving me ever the benefit of the doubt. You know, my son, who is on the Gaza border as a combat soldier, you know, he's vilified. We're talking about Israel's right to exist. And I would agree with her probably on any individual point that she made. But uniquely identifying us as evil in the world is simply anti-Semitic. You can criticize Israel. That's not anti-Semitism. That's not anti-Zionism. But when you say that the Jewish state essentially is uniquely evil, that is simply anti-Semitism. And I'm telling you, I feel like there's glee on the left when Israel does bad things. I feel like there's absolute glee, and it kills me.
I don't know when Representative Omar said Israel is inherently evil. When was that said, those specific words?
So it's just like someone who says, like, oh, what I'm doing isn't racist, but it's part of something that is a racist infrastructure. She's part of something bigger that is anti-Semitic. I'm not saying that she personally, but if you're part of something, you got to recognize your complicity in it.
But it's not really fair, is it, to say she said something that she didn't say? And I feel like a lot of people are saying she's saying this thing that she didn't say.
If you're identifying her as the topic of this conversation, I'm responding to that. And I am saying she is part of something much bigger, that it's not just her.
What do you make of the fact that many American Jews have come out and said they agree with Ilhan Omar?
They're different people than me. And I also think there's really a litmus test on the left, and that you have to pretty much be, for some parts on the left, you have to be anti-Israel to get in. And we've seen it over and over and over again.
Rabbi Susan Silverman lives in Jerusalem. Thanks very much, and safe travels back to Israel.
Thank you for reaching out. All the best.
It is among the most sensitive topics the Vatican has faced in recent decades. Why didn't the leader of the Catholic Church speak out forcefully about the persecution and mass murder of European Jews? Historians might know a bit more soon. Pope Pius XII was head of the Church at the end of World War II, and documents from his papacy have been off limits to researchers. But this week, Pope Francis announced that he'll open many of Pius XII's records next March.
He was no fan of Hitler or of Nazism. The question is how he might have tried to accommodate to Nazi rule.
David Kurtzer is the author of The Pope and Mussolini.
Pius XII saw Nazism as pagan and, in fact, was worried that the Nazi regime was engaged in a battle against the Catholic Church in Germany. But he also was someone who was very diplomatic and, for various reasons, was not eager to publicly denounce the Nazi regime or its extermination of the Jews.
Pius XII became pope 80 years ago. So how does this still reverberate today?
Well, there's been this festering issue about what brought about the Holocaust. I mean, to put it in the broadest, starkest terms, how is it possible that in the middle of Europe, in the middle of the 20th century, there could have been the mass murder of millions of Jews. And what role, among other contributing factors, what role the churches and Christianity played has been a big part of that debate. It's brought to a particular head by the fact that the Jews of Italy and the Jews of Rome in particular were victims of the Holocaust as well. And in perhaps the most dramatic evidence of this, when the Germans took over Rome in the fall of 1943, they tried to round up all the Jews from Rome, rounded up over 1,000 of them. They put them in a holding building right next to the Vatican, in fact. And then they shipped them out to Auschwitz, where virtually all of them were murdered. And the Pope never spoke openly against this. So the big question from my point of view is, and this rarely gets stated in this way, is how was it that people who thought they were Christian, as most of these murderers were, thought of themselves as Christians, could murder Jewish women and children and still think they were good Christians? And what might religious leaders, Christian religious leaders, so Protestant as well as Catholic, have done to try to stop this?
Do you think there's any evidence in the archive that might help us understand the answer to that?
Well, yes. From my reading so far of the evidence, I think, and in this case, maybe there's some parallel to the more recent pederasty sex scandal in the church, that the perspective of the Vatican was largely the first priority has to be to protect the institutional church and everything else comes second. And the Pope was certainly worried that the Nazi regime would work against the church, as it had in various ways. It had limited the influence of the church in Germany and elsewhere, where in Poland, where it took over, and Austria and so on. So I think we may well find more documentation that will show that this is, you know, exactly the kind of consideration that was overriding in the Pope's decision-making at the time.
The Vatican is also opening up records from the post-war period, which for Italy kind of begins in 1944 with the Allied troops liberating Rome. Here's actually Pius XII addressing those very anxious troops.
You have had experience now of the dangers and uncertainties of life in the midst of a war. Make one thing certain, that you keep always close to God.
Keep always close to God. That's Pope Pius XII addressing troops, Allied troops liberating Rome in 1944. David Kurtzer, what are you eager to learn about Pius XII and Italy's transition out of fascism?
Well, this is, in fact, I think, where we might find the most surprising and new kinds of materials, not so much for the war, although I think there'll be plenty of interesting material there as well. But remember, we already have thousands of documents that have been published by the Vatican based on the war years, whereas virtually nothing has been published or available about the immediate post-war period, which in Italy was dramatic. In Italy, there was well-grounded fears that the communists were going to come to power, which from the Vatican's point of view would be a total disaster. And so the Pope was undoubtedly working furiously behind the scenes to prevent this, but at the same time had to take the public position that the Vatican remained outside of partisan politics. So exactly how this played out behind the scenes, I think, is going to lead to many revelations from these newly opened archives.
David Kurtzer, you spent the better part of your life looking at and researching the Catholic Church in World War II. Have you booked your ticket already to go to the Vatican next March?
They're opening the archives March 2nd, 2020. And yes, I'm planning to be on the doorstep on that day.
David Kurtzer, author of The Pope and Mussolini, winner of the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for biography, by the way. David Kurtzer, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, the cyclist who made headlines for riding too fast. We'll explain. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Brexit debate has taken many twists and turns. The latest, fear of chlorinated chicken from the U.S. Some chicken processors here use chlorine as a disinfectant. The European Union banned the practice in the late 1990s. Now that the U.K. is leaving the EU, or is expected to, there are concerns that U.S. chicken and other American meat products will make it to British shores. U.S. Ambassador to the U.K., Woody Johnson, told the BBC today that concern about U.S. meat is just fear-mongering.
American farmers care about their land just as much as they do here and their animals. I would submit that a lot of these statements are designed, perhaps by the EU, to create barriers, really, to U.S. farm products.
So why is chlorinated chicken seen as such a bad thing? Eric Millstone is an expert in science policy at the University of Sussex in the UK.
Well, there are several reasons why chlorinated chicken's problematic, but it's important to appreciate that in U.S. food productions, it's not just chlorinated water that's used as a disinfectant. Actually, a total of six different chemical disinfectants are used. And there seems to be some evidence actually they are ineffective. A very important study emerged from the University of Southampton in spring of last year showing that the effect of washing with chlorinated water was not to diminish, weaken, or kill the bacteria. It just made them much harder to detect, which perhaps accounts for why it is the case that there are high rates of microbiological food poisoning in the USA compared with the UK and Europe, even though all those chemical disinfectants get used in the US.
What do we mean exactly when we say chlorinated? What does the process actually do?
Well, chlorine gas is dissolved in water, and that chlorinated water is then used as a chemical wash to try to reduce levels of infectious material on foodstuffs.
So there's a big Brexit concern around this. Like, if Britain leaves Europe, what is your worry about chlorinated poultry from the United States?
Well, as I say, it's not just poultry, and it's not just the use of chemical disinfectants. I think there are many reasons why U.S. food products are much less safe than they are in the U.K. and Europe. One reason is that because there are such high levels of infectivity in U.S. livestock, which is mostly because animals are packed together much more closely in poultry sheds or cattle sheds or pig units than is deemed acceptable in Europe, you have much higher levels of infection because the bacteria and viruses more readily pass from animal to animal. And in U.S. livestock production, very high levels of antibiotics are administered to the animals. Estimates that I've seen suggest that in the last 10 years, the use of antibiotics in U.S. livestock farming has doubled, whereas in Europe, it's halved. And the overuse of antibiotics is contributing to the increase of antibiotic-resistant infections. Mm. So that's one of the problems.
I mean, even if Britain leaves Europe, which it probably will, I mean, won't there still be standards that will have to be met in the U.K.? Won't you still be looking at food coming in?
Well, it's too soon to tell whether the UK is going to leave the EU, when and on what terms. But it's interesting that it's not just your UK consumers that are concerned about lower standards on imports from the USA. The retailers, the supermarkets don't want it. The UK farmers don't want it either. And especially as continental European member states are a very large export market for UK producers. And if UK producers want to sell their products in continental Europe, they have to comply with EU standards. And they don't want to have higher standards for exports and lower standards for domestic consumption. That just makes life too complicated.
And when it comes to actually chlorinating chicken, why was that process not banned here in the United States?
Well, my understanding is simply that U.S. agricultural producers, you know, farmers, the agribusiness companies are a very powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. There are critics of their policies, but sadly, they seem to be much less influential in the congressional lobbies than are the big agribusiness corporations.
Eric Millstone, Emeritus Professor of Science Policy at the University of Sussex. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much indeed.
Okay, here's a wild story. Maybe you saw the headline. A Swiss cyclist was going so fast in her race that she had to be stopped when she caught up to the men's race. Nicole Hanselmann is that cyclist. She rides with the Bigla Pro Team. Hanselmann held the lead that day in the women's pack, the Peloton, as it's known. As is the convention in cycling, the men and women were in separate races, the men starting off before the women.
Actually, I was alone in the lead, and suddenly I saw more police cars in front of me. I catched up the ambulances of the men's convoy, and then the commissaire called me next to his car, and he told me that they will neutralize the race because we are getting too close to the men.
So, to put it briefly, I mean, you were going really fast.
Yeah, I tried to get as much time ahead of the women's bunch. for the upcoming cobblestone section. Mm. Yeah, it was a bit sad that I had to stop then because I was quite in a good flow at that moment. And if you have to stop, you just lose this flow.
This has generated, though, as you know, a lot of discussion around gender. A big question I have is why divide the race according to gender to begin with? I mean, look at some running races. People all run together, men and women. Their times are logged and then they get divvied up. So why not do the same in cycling?
If you look at that specific race, it was like we had 123Ks, the men's had 200Ks, and we did the same start lap or course, and then the both races went different ways. It would be quite difficult if we start racing together. Then some have to go straight, the others right, and it's not so easy.
Is it time to at least kind of look at other alternatives, like maybe running the races on different days?
I think it's nice for us to have it on the same day and on similar time slots, because if you have separate days, also the spectators have to come out on 2 days. And, you know, women are always complaining when they have to start in the morning, like at 8 or 9 o'clock, and then the men start in the afternoon. So I think the organizer did a great effort to put both races together.
What have your fans and supporters been saying about this, Nicole?
I think many of them don't really know cycling. We stopped quite early in the race, so we haven't entered any of the cobblestone section, or we didn't have done any climb till then. It was fine for the whole layout of the race. And
you're pretty casual about what happened in this race where you had to stop. Honestly, though, it must have felt pretty good to have actually caught the lads and knowing that you're faster than the ones in the back of the peloton.
I didn't thought that it will go so worldwide.
Well, it did go worldwide, and work it. That's all I can say. Cyclist Nicole Hanselmann, thank you very much for your time.
No problem.
I'm Marco Werman. 50 years ago, Indira fell in love with a fellow med student in India. His parents belonged to a higher caste, and they did not approve.
His family said I may have performed some black magic to make him fall for me.
Marrying across caste lines. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Who doesn't like a good love story? Girl meets boy, girl and boy fall in love, but then family intervenes and so does a feud. The plot of so many romances, think Shakespeare or Hollywood. It's also the story of reporter Kavita Pillay's parents. They were both born in Southwest India, but into different castes. And when they married against their family's wishes, it did not go over well. Today, we continue our series, Caste in America, a reporting partnership with WGBH and the Pulitzer Center. Kavita Pillay looks at her parents' experience as an inter-caste couple and how their caste identity makes a difference to them here in the U.S.
I like to tell myself that deep down, my overprotective, suburban, Indian immigrant parents are still rebels with a cause. That's because 50 years ago, they fell in love and married across caste lines.
Hi.
How are you guys?
Good. How are you? Hi, Dad.
In 1969, for two people of different castes to get married was considered very scandalous.
It's not scandalous. It was not common.
That is why it was scandalous. Anything which was rare was scandalous.
My parents, Indira and Bala Pillay, now live in Boston, but they're from the South Indian state of Kerala. Kerala has India's highest literacy and life expectancy rates, and it's known for being very progressive compared with the rest of India.
His family went insane. They were ready to disown him. His family said things like, I may have performed some black magic to make him fall for me.
I told them, listen, I don't care about what all these relatives are talking about. I love her. I want to marry her. You may not like it. I'm sorry. If you don't like it, you can go to hell.
To my American ears, it sounds brave and romantic. Once upon a time, it was unthinkable for even the shadow of someone from my mom's caste to fall on someone of my dad's caste. That's because my dad is from the Nair caste. Nairs are a dominant caste in Kerala. Many consider themselves to be the descendants of warriors and landowners. My mom is from a lower caste called the Iravas. What was unimaginable to my grandparents became possible only because my parents met in medical school in India. They were both doctors. They saw each other as equals.
We decided to come to the U.S. to escape the feuding families.
I grew up in America not thinking about caste. My Indian American friends and I didn't have to, probably because the vast majority of Indian Americans are like my dad and come from generations of caste privilege. That privilege can help pave the way for us to do well in this country. It turns out that there are Indians who still embrace their caste status, even in America, which is what brings me to a resort outside Chicago, surrounded by golf courses and McMansions, for a convention held by the Nyer Service Society of North America. The original Nyer Service Society, or NSS, was founded in Kerala, and this is their third major convention in the U.S. Over 180 families are here from across the country and Canada. There's a lot of Nyer pride here, and the convention schedule is nonstop. There are dance workshops, a women's empowerment seminar, a fashion show, even a competition for the title of Mrs. and Mr. Nyer.
Mrs. and Mr. Nyer of Nyer Sangamam 2018.
On the second day, there's a rambling seminar that intertwines religious history with what's meant to be career advice.
That enticing of the mind is happening.
But at the end, the speaker begins comparing the caste system to different divisions in a company.
So in every company, this Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishyas, and Sudras will be there.
It's a muddled explanation, both a justification of caste and a dismissal of its realities.
And that has nothing to do with the caste system as people we are wrongly understanding in India. This is a universal pattern.
Over the course of several more panels, it's not clear whether anyone here disagrees with this stance, that the caste system is no different from a company hierarchy, until...
The hierarchical standards that are practiced in our Hindu religion do not align with my beliefs on inclusivity.
Shreya Menon is a young accounting student from New York. She begins her question by stating that she is a proud Hindu, but...
I am uncomfortable with practicing the segregation that comes with being part of the caste system. So my question is, what can NSS do to align with the youth's beliefs so that we can one day be proud, be very proud to carry on this organization into the future?
Thank you, Shreya, for asking this very important question. In fact,
the person designated to answer Shreya's question confesses his own discomfort with caste.
Yes, it has got a little inhuman quality.
He says it was originally about division of labor, but should be abolished.
But now there is reverse discrimination in Kerala, and so it is time that NSS should take an active step in trying to bring everything to parity. In fact, I've written...
So-called reverse discrimination. India has the world's oldest affirmative action program. It was written into the Indian Constitution in 1950 and authorizes quotas for marginalized groups in government and university admissions. But there's plenty of backlash. Nearly all of the convention attendees I speak with complain that it helps Dalits and lower castes get jobs and into universities, which they say makes it harder for upper castes like the Nyers. 50 years ago, my parents thought that caste was on its way to becoming an artifact of history. As it turns out, the Nyer Service Society of North America embraces the tradition of marrying within the caste. In 2017, they launched their own matchmaking website called Matrimony for Nyers, with well over 200 potential brides and grooms. For The World, I'm Kavita Pillai.
Hey, Kavita.
Hey, Rupa Shenoy. Hi.
I was wondering if I could ask you a couple questions about all that because, it resonates so much with me.
This is The World's Rupa Shenoy. Her family's also from South India.
It's really strange. Like, I have trouble, understanding how I feel about it.
One of the things that I think makes it so hard to understand caste as outsiders is that it is so confusing. It is so old. There are so... We simplify it and say, oh, there are these four or five different levels of it, but there are hundreds and thousands of subcastes. And for an outsider, it's like, whoa, I don't have a language to understand this. I don't have a way to understand this. And it can be really hard to find an entry point.
The incident that really stands out for me with this when it really hit home was when I was visiting my father's family. And the family servant who raised my father pretty much would sit there on the floor. And so I picked up my plate and got on the floor, and she was just looking at me. She was like, "This is really weird. This is where I belong. You belong up there. Mm-hmm. Please follow the rules."
Right. Yeah.
And after that, I was just like, I can't really participate or come to an opinion about this because I have no clue about it.
Yeah. I think that in a lot of ways, understanding that makes it easier to come to America and figure out hierarchies here, because we have a lot of unwritten codes that might be mystifying, you know, to outsiders as well, you know, around our social hierarchies.
That reminds me of just how Indians are model minorities here, and they are used in certain ways to pit against other minorities here. So it sounds like this almost helps Indians play into that, the Indians who want to participate in that.
Right. It has been used to, instead of unify us, pit us against other minorities with no recognition of the fact that, say, at least for Indian Americans, the vast majority of us come from generations of caste privilege. We hear the stories of, like, our families coming here with a handful of dollars in their pocket and one suitcase. And we don't realize there's a lot of stuff that set them up in India and then in the U.S. to do really well.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the story, you say, you know, I hadn't thought about this before. And I think I mentioned I hadn't thought about it before really either. And that, to me, sounds like a lot of white Americans who don't have to think about racism in the U.S. So why do you think it's important to recognize privilege in this way?
Privilege is this thing that is totally invisible until you recognize it or you are made to recognize it. I grew up in Ohio. You know, as a brown girl in Ohio, I've mostly thought of myself as marginalized in America.
Me too, yeah.
And the thing is that we are both marginalized and privileged. You know, we have these binaries in America where you think, oh, you're one or the other. You're either privileged or you're marginalized. And I think for people like you and me, it's like, oh, we're actually kind of both and. There are conversations that I could have with people who have gender privilege or racial privilege or whatever it might be that I couldn't have had otherwise if I didn't recognize my own privilege, right?
So this is what really reminds me, like, the way you talk about racism being, people think it's clearly defined here. So this is racist and this is not racist in America. We think it, people tend to think of it as very clearly defined. And I think that's what was going into my thinking going to India, because nothing's clearly defined there. And it is so frustrating. But anyway, so how did your parents react to this? What did they think of you focusing on them? Because among all the Indian elders I know, it would be a bad scene.
My mom is so frank about it. I think my mom has really just embraced what happened. But I think it's also fraught, because I don't think my parents ever had a chance to feel like, oh, we really bucked the system. And I think because I'm one generation separated, they had some distance to process it a little bit, right?
Did you always know that they were an intercaste marriage, or did you find it out at some point?
I don't remember ever not knowing. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that I knew anything about caste. I would just have to kind of watch and observe, oh, why are my aunties kind of stressed out when my dad's family comes to visit? Why does this seem like such a big deal? But it's been a process of fitting things together, I would say.
That's reporter Kavita Pillay and the world's Rupa Shenoy talking about their family's experiences as part of our series, Caste in America. Tomorrow, we'll go deeper into the question of how caste still exists for Indians living in the U.S. Here's something we've been tracking for the last few months. The Democratic Republic of Congo is battling the worst outbreak of Ebola in its history and the second biggest Ebola outbreak anywhere ever. At least 500 people have died and more than 800 people infected since August. It's a special challenge because the outbreak began in an area of northeast Congo that's never had Ebola. Another problem, that part of the country has armed militia groups, and suspicion of health workers runs high. The BBC's Anne Soy went to the city of Beni to report on the conditions that made the Ebola infection in Congo spread so fast.
As we enter the hospital gate in Beni, the soles of our shoes are sprayed with a disinfectant and we wash our hands in chlorine water. Nobody shakes hands here anymore. Ebola is spread through infected bodily fluids. This has been a major test for the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's dealt with 9 previous outbreaks, mostly in remote villages in the west where they were easily contained. In a country as big as Western Europe, but with poor infrastructure, few knew about Ebola in the east, and the ignorance at the beginning of the outbreak only fueled infections. But a lot has changed over the last 6 months. A short distance away, 19-year-old Rachel Masika is lulling a baby strapped to her back to sleep. She is dressed in a sky blue gown and gloves. 2 rows of orange mesh separate me from Rachel. The baby she's carrying has symptoms of Ebola. Samples from his body have been taken for testing. But Rachel is not at risk. She is one of more than 250 survivors in this outbreak who are now thought to be immune. But she is lucky to be alive. 10 other members of her family died.
We opened the body bag and performed rituals on my mother's body. The medics warned us against it. They said she had died from Ebola, but we refused to believe them. We told them she died from food poisoning. Then they tried to persuade us to get vaccinated, but we refused and fled to Butembo.
Butembo later became a hotspot of infection. As she traveled back to Beni, Rachel fell ill.
My brother convinced me to go to hospital. He said we had already lost too many people. Finally, I agreed because I was very weak. I had been vomiting and my veins were collapsing. But they took good care of me at the hospital until I recovered.
Rachel now believes Ebola exists and she's doing all she can to help. But ignorance across this region is making dealing with the outbreak difficult.
I'm roasting meat. Can you see it?
It's wild dog, he tells me.
We don't have jobs. There's nothing to do. This is all we can get to eat. We sleep outside. We are always running, women and children. There's insecurity. They can't get education.
I explain to him that scientists say Ebola comes from infected wild animals.
Then we will all die. But for now, we'll keep eating from the wild.
A resident of Beni in northeastern Congo, ending that report from the BBC's Anne Soy. Scientists this week are getting their first up-close look ever at a massive Antarctic glacier that could play a big role in global sea level rise. The researchers are aboard the icebreaker Nathaniel B. Palmer, and the world's own Carolyn Beeler is with them. We've been checking in with Carolyn throughout the Palmer's 2-month expedition, and we've got her on the line again today. Carolyn, the ship reached the Thwaites Glacier last week. You told us then it was the first time anyone had actually been there and seen it up close like that. So what has the crew been up to now that they're finally there?
So after I checked in last week, some weather blew in and we had wind gusts up to like 70 miles an hour, I think. They were, you know, picking up the waves and blowing them around. And it was really hard to stand up, in fact. So we had to turn away from the glacier for a little while. But now we're back. It's not any warmer. It's about negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit with the wind chill. But all the science teams are really busy with their research. And as we go back and forth along the face of floating ice shelf of Thwaites, everyone here who's seen an ice shelf before is commenting on how strange it looks.
So it doesn't look like ice shelves I've seen before. This one looks like big icebergs and ice cubes just frozen together. It looks very chaotic.
So he says the glacier looks very chaotic. I mean, what does chaotic look like for a glacier? And does that worry him?
Yeah, so instead of this sheer cliff of ice, the sheet is sort of sloping down into the sea. There's a lot of fractures and it's looking just like very jumbled up. And yeah, that is a sign of the instability of this ice sheet. And it's what the scientists are down here to learn more about.
One thing that was happening earlier in the voyage, Carolyn, some of the researchers were tagging seals with sensors to track ocean temperatures and gather other data near the Thwaites Glacier. So now that the scientists are at Thwaites, what else are they doing?
Well, scientists think that Thwaites is melting and destabilizing primarily because warmer ocean water is reaching the floating underside of it. So they know that this warmer, saltier water is here, but they don't know how much heat exactly it's bringing to the face of Thwaites, or if it's been around for a long time, or if it's largely been brought by changing wind patterns linked to climate change. So on this cruise, scientists are measuring water temperature and salinity right in front of Thwaites and looking at these troughs in the seabed to see how much this warm water is sort of getting piped in under the floating edge of the glacier. And one of the coolest new scientific toys that they have on board to help study this is this unmanned submarine that's about the length of a shipping container and has something like 20 different sensors on it. And a few days ago, I got to go hang out with the Swedish oceanographer who's in charge of this submarine while she oversaw its first mission here in front of Thwaites Glacier.
All right.
She's a very temperamental lady.
Watching the University of Gothenburg's Anna Volin wait for her automated submarine to surface is like watching a nervous parent wait for a teenager to come back from a night out.
Turn it up, transducer.
Volin's pacing back and forth on the bridge of the Palmer and talking to her team on a radio.
Yeah, you guys at the surface at the recovery position.
When she finally gets word that the sub has surfaced from its 13-hour mission, she grabs binoculars to try to spot the bright orange sub called Hugin.
Okay, Hugin is in the surface.
And heads to the front windows to look at a patch of gray sea crowded by floating ice.
Dead ahead, is it?
Yeah, got it.
Have you? Well done.
Volin finally relaxes when she spots a sliver of orange just below the surface. Her team just got the sub last year, and this expedition is its first time in polar waters. But Volin's been working toward this mission to survey the seafloor near Thwaites for 7 years.
When we applied for the money, this was the dream. Thwaites and the West Antarctic ice shelf. We made this case. We said that it's the only way to explore under floating ice shelves.
Exploring under the ice shelf is key to understanding what's going on here as warm ocean water melts Thwaites. But even after getting the money to buy the Hugin and bring it down here, there were kinks to work out. Bad weather, delays. So it looked like actually sending it under the glacier wasn't going to happen this trip. Until this moment, up on the bridge, when Volin turned away from her binoculars and the sea to tell me this.
We actually took a little tour underneath Thwaites. We didn't want to tell anyone beforehand, but we have done it now.
Really?
Yes, yes.
It went under?
Yeah.
That's huge, Anna.
Yes. This ship was the first to go underneath Thwaites ice shelf. This cruise, yeah, historical.
Let's hope this spot, Yeah.
Volin's team doesn't know yet what the Hugin actually saw, but down on the back deck, researcher Alexandra Mazur is beaming as she helps resecure the submarine after it comes back.
Alexandra, you can't stop smiling.
Yeah, because it was a very, I think, successful mission. Well, as planned, she communicated, she surfaced, recovery was perfect. Very good mission.
It's been snowing, and the Hugin team has a quick snowball fight to celebrate.
Yes.
Then they hose the seawater off the sub and remove a panel to download the data it collected.
The
next morning, some images from the Hugin's dive to the seafloor in front of Thwaites are up on Mazur's computer.
We found some very strange features. When I see that, it looks like a tank has been driving across the sea floor.
Half the scientists on the ship are crammed into a corner of the lab, puzzling over what the strange ridges might tell them about the glacier's past. The Hugin can capture features that are invisible to other instruments on the ship.
It changes the view of the seafloor massively. You just see a whole world of new stuff.
This first glimpse of the highly detailed data from the Hugin is wowing geophysicist Ali Graham and sedimentologist Becky Manzoni.
It's like I've been blind all my life, and now I've put on glasses, and I can see every individual leaf on the tree, you know? It's beautiful.
Most of the data the Hugin collected on its first Thwaites mission still need to be analyzed, and there are more missions to come on this voyage. But whatever other discoveries it turns up, Anna Volin is convinced autonomous vehicles like this one are part of the key to better understanding and protecting Antarctica.
The world's Carolyn Beeler there aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer in the sea off of Antarctica's Thwaites Glacier. Carolyn's back with us. And before I let you go, Carolyn, a quick question about the Hugin from a listener. His name is Jason Seelaff. He's from Ann Arbor and listens to us on Michigan Radio. And he wants to know what kind of testing the Hugin had to undergo before it could go under the ice shelf.
There were some technical things like getting the buoyancy right for these waters, but mostly the issue was how to safely deploy and recover this submarine in conditions that change really quickly down here. So how to make sure it doesn't surface under sea ice that's rapidly forming down here as we head into fall, and when it's too wavy for it to be safely recovered.
That's the world's Carolyn Beeler aboard the icebreaker Nathaniel B. Palmer way down under. Carolyn, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
And if you've got a question for Carolyn about the Thwaites Glacier and climate change in the Antarctic, send it along. The address is myworld@theworld.org. Also, if you want to see the Hugin, we've got photos of the sub and the Palmer's crew there at theworld.org. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.